Hello and welcome. My name is Jo Frost, and here with my co-host Peter Linus, this is Being Human. Hello.
Hey, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm all right. What's happening in your world?
Not much. It's grey, it's drizzly, but we are heading off. Our daughter's playing hockey in Holland, so we're going to go and see her and support her and possibly see her get thrashed, as the Dutch are very good at hockey.
Very nice.
But
very
good
nice.
Experience, good learning, apparently, is
sure.
What we say.
That's what you're going for. Okay, you're prepared already for her to lose. Is that what you're telling me?
Yes, we've been pre-counseling her in preparation. So we'll see. We'll see. You never know. They could surprise us. But as their club team is playing, I think like the Dutch national under-14 team, I think their chances
slightly
are slim.
Like the FA Cup, though, for hockey, by the sounds of it. You never know. The underdog could do it.
Well, that would definitely be an upset. We'll see. So that'll be fun. Is it sunny in your world?
It's trying. I think that's the generous thing. But it is light enough now that Frosty Youth Centre is up and running again. There is invariably at least half a dozen young people, kids running rampant in my house. And my daughter just seems to go out and find more. And I'm like, I have no idea who you are. Where do you live? Where have you come from? Will you ever go home? But the worst one. So our car was recently written off, right? And we're still sat outside our house waiting for the scrappage haulage people to come and pick it up. The kids have been asking to jump on top of it forever. And my husband finally said yes. So he's leaning against the front door watching all these kids stand and sit on top of the car. And the neighbours are all looking out the window going, what are you doing to the neighbourhood? This is West Wimbledon, don't you know? Lowering the tone.
You're the people diminishing house values one at a time.
Beautiful. It's a beautiful thing. Okay, so what are we chatting about today?
I was about to ask you that question. Don't put me under pressure. It is social media and the mental health crisis. And particularly,
I suppose,
angling on young people in particular. Us being parents and avid social media users, but not young people.
Well, I mean, speak for yourself. No, I'm just a wannabe. I do notice that you and I are parents. We both have girls as kids, and we're definitely hitting that kind of teenage space. And yet we spent a lot of our kind of professional life chatting about societal and cultural trends. And so on a personal level, I think you and I get asked about this issue more than any other. How do you parent? How are young people coping? What is the impact of social media on the mental health of our kids? And what do we do about it? It happens every time we go out.
Yes. Oh, totally. But it is probably worth saying that although we're parents, we're not. This affects everybody. Nearly everybody uses social media in some shape or form. You might be a grandparent, an aunt, an uncle. You might be a user yourself. So, I mean, because some people suddenly hear, oh, no, we're going to get a parenting lesson. It's not exclusively that. They were definitely going to lean towards that, probably because I think the Molly Russell case is the moment where this probably bounced into the public consciousness most clearly.
So remind us, what is that?
Molly Russell was a 14-year-old girl who took her own life. This case, now 2022 is when the inquest was heard. So the coroner gave his findings, and he said that she took her own life while suffering from depression and had interacted with harmful social media content, and that this in more than a minimal way, a bit legal there, but you know what I mean, that more than a minimal way had impacted on her death and why she took her own life. And it became clear during the case, Instagram and others were called. Instagram were probably the people primarily in the firing line, that content had been directed towards her. She had gone searching, but then all the content had been directed towards her in a very significant way. The NSPCC were really calling for tech companies to be much more heavily regulated. And we have seen an online safety bill post that, although I'd say with somewhat limited impact. Childline NSPCC were saying that they do 73,000 counselling sessions about mental health in a year. This was 2020 to 21, and 24,000 counselling sessions about suicidal thoughts and feelings. So that's why we're absolutely linking the social media piece here with mental health at all sorts of level. This was the arrow tip at the most serious end, but we're all being thrown content that is unhelpful and shapes us in various ways.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing, isn't it? That people are picking up on the headlines and some of the stats and research that's coming out that seems to be drawing a link between the rise of social media and the intelligence behind the algorithm to just feed stuff. And then the susceptibility of developing minds and how that is affecting who they see themselves as, their own humanity, their mental health, their being in the world. So that is why this is an obvious conversation for us as being human. We're going to use the lens to explore this. So Peter, remind people, how does the lens work and how are we going to be engaging here?
Yes, the lens centers everything. It's the new apologetic. It is the definitive answer to all your questions, in case you're wondering. The lens is at the center is, what does it mean to be human? We ask that question. We look, we're going to put this issue then at the core of the lens this time, social media and our mental health kind of crisis that's going on. If we put that at the center of the lens and in the focal point, then we are going to work our way around significance, like we matter, why we matter, what is social media doing to how we view ourselves, connection, how it's going to shape the relationships and the connections that we have, what's the impact that that's having and how that impacts our mental health. Then presence, we talk a lot about being physically present with one another, about being embodied beings, about place that we live. Social media takes us out of that in many ways, but in very particular ways, we want to unpack what that's doing with our relationship with the kind of here and now that we're inhabiting. And then finally, participation, because my wife's one of the many people who says, why are you on these things sometimes? And that's a valid and legitimate question, but we do lots of our lives. We participate a lot on social media. So we want to wrestle with the question is, can we do that well? Why do we do that? And how do we navigate some of the chaos of being in those moments? So yes, we work our way around the four parts of the lens, but by putting social media and the mental health crisis right at the center.
Okay, so we are starting off with significance. You matter. It is important. Your being in the world is significant in its own right. Peter, how does social media and the mental health crisis, how does this get affected by that area of significance?
So a guy called Jonathan Haidt is a social psychologist. He has written a number of books, The Mollycoddling of the American Mind, I think was first, but The Anxiety Crisis is his more recent one. You can also go to his website. He has lots of data and research out there on essentially social media in particular, our online engagement and how that is shaping our brains, how it deforms fundamentally our brains and our hearts, particularly around anxiety, depression, and suicide. And basically, he and a number of other people, a lady, Twenge, I don't know if that's the right way to pronounce her name, T-W-E-N-G-E. They've done...
They confidently go for it.
Just go for it, go for it. And they have both produced significant research. That 2010 was like a turning point moment where we began to see really increased rates of depression, anxiety, and suicidal tendencies and ideation. And that the key thing in that is social media use. It's not just phones per se, it's that social media use. Instagram is probably, again, the people most in the firing line here. And it is significantly higher for girls. It affects both, though. So sometimes that gets lost, that boys are also impacted by this. There may or may not be a separate conversation on gaming later, and because they do affect the two groups differently, but massively distinct in girls. I mean, much higher rates. So one of the things we said in the book was most teenage girls in the US, so it's 57%, say that they experience persistent sadness and hopelessness, while almost a third say they have seriously considered suicide. So you kind of read that and then you want to say, hold on, let's just read that, just pause and go. 57% of teenage girls in the US, persistent sadness and hopelessness, and a third that they have seriously considered suicide. So those are just massive numbers.
And anyone that is engaging with young people in this moment, you just can't not just take a breath and consider that for a moment. Now, I'm a woman, therefore I have been a teenage girl. I know, shocking. And I do remember the teenage years and puberty and the kind of the intensity of that. I remember the mental health crises that some of my friends and peers were going through. That was around But I would say that it was rare. There were one or two kids who were struggling, and it just feels like the exacerbation of the struggle of being a teenager has just got profoundly more complicated and more severe. And that is basically what Jonathan Haidt is suggesting, that these things have always been around, but the prevalence of them has astronomically increased. Is that fair to say?
Yes. We've migrated childhood onto a virtual world, and that has radically disrupted social and neurological development. So he uses the example, he says, imagine you can go on a trip to Mars and you're going to send a 10-year-old to Mars. You know, before you would do that, you'd need parental consent, you'd need to think about it, you need to work through all the implications, you would think this is going to an entirely different civilization, culture, place entirely. You go through this massive set of testing criteria. We've done almost none of that. We've allowed this thing in, and most of us have allowed, if we're parents, or have been given, if we're younger, access to a phone at a level that's just, unprecedented. I said it before, when I grew up, because I'm slightly older than you, you could get a Nokia 6310, and all you could do was, you know, it was incredibly expensive to do anything on it for starters. But secondly, all you could do was play a game of Snake. You know, you couldn't spend more than 15, 20 minutes on it a day. And we're now at 3, 4, 5 hours a day. And regardless of anything else, whether it was good or bad, that level of shift is just massive. And we, you know, most people are saying we do get the dopamine hit off it. We do get hits, and therefore it's a drug, it's addictive. And we have done almost no research, and we are literally handing, not just our kids, we're saying that as parents, but every one of us has a drug. I have a drug in my hand. This phone, one of the conversations I have with my daughter is, I'm not saying she can't outwit the phone in any different way than I can't. I'm like, I am 48 years old and this thing's going to beat me, because it has had billions of pounds invested in it and all the apps on it to try and get my attention permanently. And guess what? It's pretty good at it, and it wins. It beats me most days in terms of getting my attention. So what chance does a 10, a 14, an 18, a 25, like, this isn't age specific. Like, it's a crazy game in which the odds are fundamentally stacked against. This is like walking into a casino and thinking you're going to win when the odds are set every time to make sure the house wins. Of course it does.
So when it comes to this exploration in specifically in the significance quadrant, which is where we look at questions around dignity and identity, and this pull to the dopamine hit, the how many followers have you got, how many likes did you get, suddenly going silent, have you just been trolled or bullied or shadow banned or whatever it is, that kind of roller coaster that social media propels you on. This is our classic question, what's the better story? What does the God story, or what can we offer to young people, or 48 year olds trying to put the phone down because it is having a detrimental effect on how we see ourselves? What's the alternative? What's the better story here?
It's a really challenging question. I think the first thing is that image does matter, because it's easy to kind of go be critical of an image-driven culture and say, oh, like, well, everybody's so image conscious and why does that? And you're like, actually, the biblical text does remind us that we are image bearers, and that who our image and whose image we are made in is actually really fundamental. So rather than, I think my first tendency might have been a bit dismissive of image consciousness, saying that there's a reason this works. We are driven by image. Image is important. So the way we present ourselves, the way we understand ourselves is really critical to our significance. And that's legitimate, but this thing is impacting it. So the first thing to say is it's understandable. It's incredibly important. And then it does go to questions around identity more than probably anything else. You have a profile, you have a bio, you have a way of presenting yourself. We take pictures of ourselves. We tell certain stories of ourselves on social media. All of us do. I mean, my bio tells you in whatever number of characters, 140 on Twitter, something about me. I dread to think what my Facebook bio says. It's so old now, but Instagram will create some level of imagery around me. And I make some conscious choices. So it's not my family sharing story space. It's a workspace for me, but it still presents a certain image. So we need to acknowledge that. And you can be on the receiving end of social media pylons. You know, you and I probably more so have been on some of those to do with work. So you get what's said back. People find it incredibly easy to say things that they would never say face to face to you. And we can say those to other people. So we need to be really conscious about how we engage. And I'll tell one, as a lawyer, somebody's trained, I'm quite used to stepping back from that. And I don't find it particularly toxic space for me personally. But I know for loads of other people, they do. And of course they do. I remember a pastor once saying to me about engaging in this space. And I said, you probably shouldn't, because you actually like people and they like you. You will worry about what they say. I have learned to a certain degree, these people are not annoyed at me. They're annoyed at something I believe or a position I hold. But that's not a natural way to necessarily respond. So you've got to realize how toxic it is. And it does go after our dignity and our identity. And it's incredibly shaping. So yes, we're shaped by a different story. But I also want to acknowledge why it's so significant, because our significance is so tied to our image in that moment. So I think it's really naive just to say, oh, just ignore it or to downplay it. We are going to engage and say, yeah, of course it's important. What would you, your top tips on it?
No, I love it. I especially love that basically we've all just heard you say that you're really weird. So I appreciated that greatly.
I don't deny it.
I think it really does absolutely come down to that question of how do I know who I am, and how do I appear? How am I perceived? How is my identity received? And some of that is a projection. Like you said, you put photos out, you release stories, you offer comment. But that's quite carefully curated. We show certain bits of our lives, but not others. And so there's this sense almost immediately that there's a slight falsehood in the identity we're projecting. And then there's that fear that if people actually saw the real fullness of who we are, what would they then think? And I think that's what social media ultimately plays on. If they knew the real me, what would they say and what would they think? And I think for me, that's where the God story is so profoundly beautiful, because there is a being in the world that knows somebody completely, fully, deeply, that sees all of their aspects and says, you are known and you are loved. Come to me first. Social media always puts doubt at the center of the stories. What if they reject you? What if this post doesn't get enough likes? What if they comment? Whereas the God story always says, there is no what if. You are known, you are seen, you are beloved. And that is a very different story to the one that's coming out these days.
Good. Yeah, that's so good, so good. Now, you've more to say, I know, undoubtedly, but we're going to have to push the connection. I mean, these things are linked, so it's not like these are fundamentally different sections, but it naturally begins to lead us to how we do that in a more interactive way with other people.
Now, we're going to kick off connection, which is the idea that we matter to each other. With a quote from one of your favourite films. You sat down with your oldest daughter before she was allowed a smartphone and insisted that she watch The Social Dilemma, which I think is a genius strategy. And it was this the point that you were introduced to, what's his name? Jaron Lanier.
Yeah. So you probably heard that phrase, if you're not paying for the product, then you are the product. And on so many of the social media platforms, we don't pay overtly for them, so we're being charged. But he in The Social Dilemma has this quote. He's the kind of daddy of virtual reality spaces. He's a strange looking character, but very insightful in certain areas. He says, we have created a world in which online connections have become primary, especially for younger generations. And yet in that world, anytime two people connect, the only way it's financed is through a sneaky third person who's paying to manipulate those two people. So we've created an entire global generation of people who were raised within a context where the very meaning of communication, the very meaning of culture is manipulation. We put deceit and sneakiness at the absolute center of everything we do, which we've used somewhere else. I mean, I find it fascinating, kind of Genesis 3 moment, but basically it's just saying, because Facebook, which was his primary target, I think at the time, is free, it's connecting two people. But the only way for that to work is it has to somehow finance that connection. And we've done it as a church, we've done it as an EA organization. We pay for Facebook ads at time. In the reality of that, in our paying £10, £20 to advertise to a particular group of people, part of how that's done is they are leveraging a connection to find another Christian in the age bracket, we might have said, or in the area. And so that is the reality of how the thing works. That's how Twitter, that's how Instagram, that's how they make their money. They're trying to commercialize that transaction at a tiny level, but then we do that hundreds and hundreds of times a day. So he's saying the very thing is premised on manipulation and financing and a deceitful sneakiness.
Yeah. I think for me, the clearest place to have a look at this is around dating apps.
Tell us about your experience of dating apps, Jo.
Thankfully, genuinely thankfully, me and my husband got together in real life, pre-dating app. But I must admit, I do sit around the lunch table at work chatting about dating apps and I just don't get them, because it feels like it is, you're just surveying it like you would a job interview. You're reading people's CVs. You're seeing if they match your criteria, if the algorithm that is commercially motivated thinks that you could potentially be a good match. Bearing in mind also, the financial model needs you to stay single for a while because it needs you to keep being on the app. So there's always that. So then you go out and you have a 2-hour job interview, at which point you go, yes, we're compatible, let's carry on. Also, what happens when the person who turns up is nothing like the person that you thought you wanted, but is actually the person that breaks all the rules? And I find that kind of mediated, the word you just used was manipulated, but I'm going to go with mediated. There's this mediated relationship that means that in some way, again, you're not quite in control. There's a little bit of doubt. There's a little bit of manipulation, and it screws up our relationships. And we shouldn't be surprised then when 49.6% of adults in the UK reported feeling lonely, and 7% of them experienced chronic loneliness, which means that they often or always feel alone. That's astounding.
Yeah, we have these data points about loneliness. Like, we are in a loneliness epidemic. We had a loneliness minister appointed, I think it was in 2019 in the UK. I'm not sure they're still there. And then it was like, nobody knows what to do, because we know that social media is a factor in this. We know that online time is a factor. It's not a simple linear, oh, just because we're online, we're suddenly lonely. But there is a massive correlation. We have to look then at what causes it and how it all holds together. So we're not trying to paint a simple, social media bad narrative. We both have social media and we'll talk more about how we use it in various ways. And we're not saying we've got it right either. So it's not a simple critique, but we can't also deny the level of stats around how life has changed and what it is doing. One of the results is huge levels of loneliness. Another result is the inability to hold that kind of basic startup conversation that you might have had in early days of dating, the kind of water cooler conversations because of work from home. There are small ways in which we've lost some of the smaller art of conversation, chatting to people in the tube. It's a funny thing as an outsider, if you go into London and try and chat to anybody in the tube, as you know, very weird, don't do it. But
you're not allowed.
And I'm not saying I do. I know you're not allowed. It's weird. But those spaces of even just small levels of conversation have transitioned. And you don't tend to have it between neighbors the way you used to have. But we do different. We do conversation online, but it is different. It's not bad necessarily, but we have to acknowledge you can't read social cues in the same way. You can't see the visual necessarily, depending on what format you're using. And it's very curated, and that's very different.
And because these connections are happening in a virtual space, there is an isolation built in. You are connecting, but right now, Peter, you're not in my physical space where there's an ocean between us. Which means even in the connection moments, there is a gap, there is an isolation. And I find it fascinating what that does to us. Miley Cyrus Flowers was the biggest song of 2023. And the whole point of it is, I don't need you to make me feel better. I can buy myself flowers. I can talk to myself for hours. I don't need you. And that whole idea that connection, love, I love myself better than you can, is just this kind of, I need to create my own island. And we're not considering the impact of isolation and loneliness will have on our mental health. Ted Lasso just makes me laugh. And there's this brilliant clip in season 1 where Ted walks up to Rebecca, Hannah Waddingham's character, and says, and asks her if she's ever been to a therapist, to which she laughs and says, why would I if I can diagnose myself in a heartbeat? I thought being invulnerable would protect me, so I pushed people away for years, leading to my greatest fear, being alone. And you're like, and that just sums up so many of the conversations that I have with people about this idea of self-protection and self-affirmation, but actually all that does is disconnect us from the people around us.
Okay, so we could probably push in, and I mean, if you're listening, you undoubtedly have your own stories about how social media is impacting your connections. And again, we want to say, I have connected with people on social media spaces, sometimes through DM and others. You've built work connections or just interesting engagements. Anybody invites me to speak, I always have to say, please email me, because I can't never find them. Where somebody invites you on Twitter or Facebook, you're like, just email me, I can never find where it is. And then I'll not turn up at your church because I'm like, where am I supposed to be going? But anyway, so it has, like, there are lots of ways in which we can connect online that then lead to something else that's really interesting. So we could probably go on about like the problems and diagnosing the problems, probably the easiest bit of this. And again, listeners are probably saying the same thing in this area. What about this? What about this? But the question we really want to keep centering on is, what is the better story? What's the alternative that we are offering as Christians in this moment?
I think the conversation here is around expressive individualism. If I'm the center of my story, all of my relationships, all of my connections, they revolve around me, which is why Rebecca has pushed everybody away, which is why Miley Cyrus is singing that she's going to buy herself flowers. She can't trust. She can't put herself out there. It's too risky. It's too vulnerable. Go away. Instead of recognizing that actually generosity in a relationship, connection that goes beyond how somebody makes me feel, but actually is about accepting and loving the wholeness of who we are and engaging on that kind of level. Saying that there is a love out there that you don't have to be afraid of. You don't have to fear rejection. You don't have to put all the boundaries up and all the barriers up. That actually relationship isn't just about how you feel, but is about building connection and building community that goes beyond that. That's a really powerful story, because ultimately we do not want to be alone. And our God story says that we are made in the image of a relational being who invites us to be in relationship with him.
Yes, absolutely. I think this is the reality, and that connection so often happens in real life, which takes us naturally to presence. And the reality of being embodied in a particular time and place. And, you know, we've already noted that ironically, we record this from two different spaces. There's an ocean between us. Because we know each other and because we do interact face to face at times, we find that actually works easier sometimes than being in an office where it all goes wrong. So there's interesting ways. And the boundary is porous, I think, is one of the points I want to make in presence. So
what do you mean by that?
So a couple of nights ago, Lucia, my youngest one, wanted to do an origami, like a little paper dragon. So we're watching YouTube for the very purpose of doing something in real, folding this piece of paper and turning it into a little dragon. And so many of the things we see online do cross into real life. So some of that's a very obvious intentional one. We're watching an instructional video to learn how to do this thing or to cook something or to make something. But in the Molly Russell case, to go back to that for a minute, the point there was the boundary was porous, because she found material, not always that she even was looking for, that was selected and given to her during binge periods. And Netflix and Pinterest knew there were these binge periods where people go on and romanticize self-harming of young people. And that's what the coroner found very specifically in that case. And then because of her vulnerability, her depressive illness that she already had, her age, she was already 12 and she was accessing at 13 this material, that affected her mental health in a negative way and contributed to her death in a more than minimal way, that line. So the boundaries pours there. So we know it very obviously when we're doing the teaching video, but what we sometimes fail to recognize is we're watching all this other content that begins to influence us and stimulate us. And in her case, romanticized self-harm. She's vulnerable, she's predisposed to this. And it leads to an in real life act where she ends her own life because of that content coming. So recognizing that these things cross the boundaries is I think one of the more significant pieces that we need to do. It cuts both ways. We take our real lives and present a version of them online, and those online are taken back into real life.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. My youngest was complaining that she's not on Snapchat because she's not on any social media because she's 10. And yeah, all her mates are. And so she was moaning that why couldn't she have Snapchat? And I was like, well, the problem with Snapchat is the filters, because you're looking at what looks like a mirror. So your brain is telling you that this is what you look like. So that in reality, when you do look in a mirror, you don't look right, or you don't think that's how you should look, or you've seen so many other faces with filters on it, you assume that your face is somehow wrong, and it starts to create this kind of distorted reality. And she looked at me and nodded and walked off. Anyway, next day, her mate comes over, has got Snapchat, is taking photos, puts the filter on until he's like, oh, why don't you just take the filter off? And the daughter goes, because I hate my face. And my daughter comes running in and says, my mate just said she hates her face off Snapchat. Oh, my goodness. And it was just this wonderful moment of going, I'm not trying to ruin your fun. I'm not trying to break you. I'm not trying to make you different to all your mates. I am putting these boundaries in because actually there is something significant about who you are and the reality of your body and what you look like. And these spaces are trying to get you to want to change that, arguably, because they can make money off that. But that's just my skepticism. But it does mean that as a parent, I really want to put some limits there, because actually, day one, she encountered exactly what I said was we were seeing in different stories.
So you reminded me, so one, that you as a parent are actually right sometimes. That's very good. Your daughter recognized that. But actually, we wrote this somewhere in the book. So in 2018, researchers discovered that 55% of plastic surgeons are now seen by patients looking to improve their appearance for selfies. So they want to recreate the effects of social media in real life. Again, that porous boundary piece where they're going to the surgeon, make me look like the filter makes me look like, so that I can be like this 100% of the time, not just in the image, which, and so, you know, we're not going to go into detail in this episode on pornography. That's another thing that creates a perception of what's available and what's real. And the filters do that. And that probably the perception versus reality is the second point, certainly for me, which, and the kind of moment for that was the Kate, Princess Kate photograph.
And now the most famous Mother's Day photo in the history of the world.
Basically, so there's sort of rumors and speculation going, and lots of people then apologized and felt bad for this, because the photo goes out, it's used by all the main photo image, photo kind of firm agencies, and then they start to withdraw it because they realize it has been manipulated. Back to that word again. At what level and how, everybody can debate, that's fine. But fundamentally, there are a few clear things that have been adjusted in it. And it's a perception reality. That photo was, I think, being released to try and say all is well. It completely failed on that story. We've now subsequently discovered that Kate had other things going on. And so we want to recognize that and absolutely be praying for her and her health in this moment. So it gets more complicated. But fundamentally, it's often the thing that we put out an image to do one thing and it does something else, because perception and reality aren't matching in these moments. And it has this very destabilizing impact on the conversation and what's happening.
Yeah. So much of that story is fascinating. What I found really interesting was how quickly social media lost their mind over that photo and all these sorts of conspiracy theories coming up saying, oh, it's been AI'd and all the rest of it. And I was like, dismiss, dismiss, dismiss. And then it kind of ratcheted up a level and people started saying, no, look more closely. And they could pinpoint where the cuff was wrong or where the fingers were wrong, or I think Charlotte's wearing a boot with a heel in one and then a flat in the other and all this sort of stuff. And it's a bit like one of those, almost like a magic eye image, where on the surface, it all looked fine. Your perception and your reality didn't seem to clash. It wasn't until you looked more closely that you realized, actually, this isn't real. It has been altered. And I think that's the other challenge of users, is that discernment. This is real. This is fiction. This is fake. This is a cartoon. This is real life. that is being blurred more and more. And that is causing so many problems when you can't navigate what is real and what is fiction. That's a terribly destabilizing space to be.
It is. Oh, absolutely. And I think this, again, is going to be our challenge then to what is the better story and how do we land that to be embedded in local community, in real life, in places in which you can't put on a filter when you go meet somebody in a cafe. You can put on a version, but I guess you put on some makeup. But, you know, fundamentally, body language becomes much clearer there. Direct engagement is very different in that space. And you probably want to say, like, one of the responses is I think sometimes the over-vulnerability, then people overshare online and try and be arguably way too honest to a wider public. And I don't think that's a healthy response either, especially when we're thinking about mental health in this moment and how we engage in that. So it is, for me, trying to navigate the realities of we live, we are embodied beings. These are frail and finite bodies. There are things going on in them. Friend last night, you mean just to saying he'd had a cancer diagnosis and then it got much worse, and just the realities of navigating that space, what that took him back to, his first wife dying of a very similar kind of diagnosis, and just processing that, but having to do that via email with him right now until we can set up a Zoom, because he's based, there are four of us who went to college, one in Scotland, one in England, one in Ireland, one in Canada. And like, so just the realities of how we get that little prayer square back together to navigate that and not be present with them in that way, but finding a space in which we can do those dialogues in a healthy way. So technology can be really helpful in doing that, but
that's
not social media sharing. Yeah. It's probably not the thing you're going to start sharing and opening up the space. Okay. So again, we're trying to navigate this kind of Luddite. We're not Luddites. We are both using technology a lot, but we're trying to say, where's the better story? So what does that look like in terms of being embodied in that moment, to be present with him, to minister to him, to, so that is, for me, one of the biggest things there is that God is present with him. And he talked about an encounter he'd had with Jesus just before this diagnosis came that has been so significant to him. It's almost like he knew it was coming, and in a retreat, he had this phenomenal encounter with Jesus. And that's something he's been able to hold on to. So when I can't be present with him, and some of the other guys in the square can't be present with him in that way, God can. So I'm so thankful for that, that we are, we worship an omnipresent, transcendent God who can be everywhere. And then we have to navigate the realities of where do we live and how do we navigate some of this moment. Actually, I had some really challenging conversations this week because the situation was in real life. Things are, much worse things are said about me online, but they just don't resonate in the same way. And then when you're in a community where this thing is bubbling around, it's really hard to navigate. It's much more personal, it engages your family much more. It's much more real life. But how do we do that? In this case, it was in a church community, and have to navigate those tough conversations and much more relational conversations, being present with one another.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why it's hard, which is often why we want to avoid it. Because I don't know about you, but I quite like avoiding conflict, quite like avoiding difficult conversations, quite like avoiding people when I'm feeling a bit rubbish or a bit vulnerable. So the retreat is a great tactic. How to be present and stay present in the hardships and in the hard moments. That is deeply costly, but it is also one of the most human things that we can do. Okay, finally, we have come full circle and we are approaching participation. What we do in the world makes a difference. It matters. So how are we engaging in this space? We're having these sort of conversations. But how do you engage well? What's your tactics when it comes to social media, staying healthy both for you as a grown-up, but also for the kids? What are some of your top tips?
Oh, I definitely don't think I've got this one cracked. So it's, you're going to say what you do. I like what you do, but I'll not preempt that. I'm not bold. So I have the apps on my phone. But I'm definitely, Twitter's probably my primary space of engagement X now, but I don't engage in anywhere near as much. It's less interesting to me than it used to be. I can't fully put my finger on all the bits of why that is. The other spaces, just Instagram and us, I use them very much in a work function. So for me, those are something I go on to consciously to do posting and to look at a little bit of stuff, but it's quite the very relatively easy time-bound moments for me. I don't find that as distracting. You've probably got a better tactic at the minute. We might have to test this now over the time. So we can come to the kids in a minute. So tell me what you do personally with those apps or what you've just shown.
It's a very new thing. So by the end of this season, you can ask me whether or not I'm still doing it. But, or if I've broken my own thing. I was just noticing that I was binging way too much and just the escapism and the kind of the checkout that social media allows you to do was becoming a little bit like, oh, I don't want to do this anymore. Too much junk food. So I've deleted them off my phone. I haven't quite got as far as deleting the account because, like we've said, we do actually use this space for work. But it was just making me unhealthy. So it's come off my phone. I've got it in my cloud library, so I can still access it, which is where am I going to break my own thing? Because I'm not very disciplined. So if I need to do anything on work, because like Instagram, especially the kind of the web-based app is awful. You can't do stuff. So you have to do it on your phone. So I will access it, but I just want it gone. So I've taken everything that was distracting off. And we'll see. I'm about 4 days in.
So we'll definitely update you on that. I actually, relatively recently, I've got more into Audible. I kind of resisted for some reason. My wife was really into it. So, and that's a kind of counter habit for me in a sense. So rather than doing the doom scrolling and when traveling and in places, and now much more intentionally listen to something interesting right now about atomic habits. So, you know, how you bring small changes into your day to build better habits in. And that's one of the things we'll always be returning to is habits and those ideas, because habits shape us. So the habit is to grab the phone in the morning. If the habit is to scroll when you're traveling on the commute, saying I won't do that isn't going to be enough. You're going to also have to look at something positive. So can be listening, reading, those kind of things. So I think that's practically some of the stuff that we're definitely experimenting with. And in one sense, being really open and saying, we haven't cracked this thing. We're still trying to work our way through what does good patterns, Sabbath rest, alternative habits look like.
Yeah. And I think that's the absolute key, isn't it? You've got to have the behavior to match, but you've also got to have the intentionality, because the algorithm is set to break you. It really wants to drive some of the attention into certain places. And I keep seeing clickbait articles come up and I'm like, oh, that's interesting. And then I'm like, I refuse to click it because I know how dehumanizing that story is. It's speculation, it's gossip, it's salacious, like scandal, whatever. And I know that I am being asked to click it and that's going to fuel the engagement. And so I'm like, actually, how do I deliberately refuse to be a part of the problem? And it's really hard.
Oh, definitely is. And so we've also talked about kids, but these are relevant to both. I think, I mean, we have settings, I think both of us have, for our kids. And they don't, the younger in both cases, I don't think have any social media access or even phones. So my 11-year-old doesn't have a phone yet. She will when she goes to secondary school. She won't have social media access. The older one, 14, doesn't. We're just saying that, not because it's great, we're just putting it out there.
That's a really hard parenting decision to make, though.
Yep.
Because you are othering your child deliberately. They are, my daughter is the only one, apparently. She's probably not, but the only one that doesn't have WhatsApp, the only one that isn't on TikTok, the only one that has to phone me because I wouldn't let her have data on her phone. And that's a very alienating space for young people. But what we're arguing is that actually the mental impact that alienation has is still less significant than the mental impact of being on some of these platforms. And I'd rather take the hit there then take the hit somewhere else. But there's a constant dialogue between her and I on, do we have to adapt? Is there something that we have to change? You're suddenly in a work group out of school and everyone's talking on WhatsApp. What do we do? But it's hard to say no to your kids.
Yes. Oh, listen, if my wife didn't take a stronger arguably view, my kids would probably get away with a lot more. So she's stronger on this in a healthy way. And we have slightly different things going on there. So, for example, my older at 14, she does have WhatsApp, but doesn't have any of the social media channels. It's so WhatsApp allows communication for certain things, but you can hear me even almost sound like I'm justifying it. So we're all processing in real time what's good and what's bad. But one of the things that's come up quite a lot in mainstream media recently is about setting these limits. This isn't just a Christian idea. I think our society has begun to realize this. Jonathan Haidt is coming at this from just a social sciences perspective, We'll put a link to an article actually from PC Mag. I was just looking at a number of things they were saying. One, you can do this. Two, you should do it. Three, you can even roll back, which feels like the hardest, and they acknowledge it often is. But the very practical things that we've already talked about, which is, you know, change the notification settings so they don't come up on the home screen. You know, you can set focus times when you're doing some work. Most of us probably do that. Managing screen time with kids. So again, there's boundaries set for my kids, and my own phone goes off, and only text from the family members can come through after 10 o'clock at night. And I didn't use it. I liked the 24-hour contact thing. That was my old lawyer thing. You're always available. Quite was up for that. And it's like, that's daft. Why would I bother? So I've just switched all those around and realized that I can be in control of so many more of those things. And because I'm not great, I set those settings primarily and then just ignore, you know, they're great. They work for me. I put mine on the darker setting, which is one step. But grayscale, I think, is the thing you really do if you're the Center for Humane Technology. It was set up by guys who set this thing up. The pings and the red and the alerts are the things that we really love as human beings. So taking a lot of those things off. So there's lots of ways of setting things up. Even the way you set your phone up, what apps are on the home screen, what are up front, the utilities that you actually use and put the other things back. And then the bolder step that you've talked about was to take them right off the phone and put them into a different device. So there are really practical ways of engaging in this conversation as adults and on behalf of the others that we think are really important to protect our own mental health and our own sanity, yeah. Frankly.
And having the confidence, I think, to keep the dialogue open if you're trying to navigate this within the family setting and with other parents, because the pressure parents feel to make sure that your kids fit in. As soon as you start talking to other parents, you discover that you're all battling the same issues. You're all struggling with the same stuff. Talk to other parents. Find out where they're hearing the pressure. Engage. But as much as anything, you're going to laugh at me. Hospitality. As much as you can, build in real life moments. My daughter was asking me yesterday if I mind her going out and playing on the street all the time. And I was like, I'd much rather you were out playing with your mates than you were sat in the house on a screen. Go. And she was like, oh, great. Because actually that is where they're going to build their sociability. That's where they're going to have to navigate conflict. That's where people see their actual faces. As much as possible, keep your house open, keep your community engaged. Do as much as you can in real life because it's a beautiful thing.
And it requires a time investment. Let's not kid ourselves. I think it was Women's Hour I was listening to just yesterday in the car. And again, it was saying how often, confession time almost, how often we set devices down in front of people. How often do we let them parent, babysit our children? And listen, I'm certainly going to confess, I've done that, I'm sure, I have. But there is an investment, as you've said. It's not just saying, hey, you can't have the phone, you can't watch this now, but we're going to do this other thing. We are going to go out, we're going to bake, we're going to make whatever it is that interests, and that requires time from us to engage. Whether it's a parent or as an individual, we have to build in a different habit, the listening to the audiobook or going for a run or going for a walk, getting your step count up, whatever is your thing is the alternative. These things will beat us if we just try digital apps on its own. Just straight detox, 99.999% of the time will not work. So you got to replace it with gratitude, with hospitality, with an intentional engagement. Somebody like Kintsugi Hope, one of our member organizations that actively engage in the mental health space. Like, what is the proactive, hopeful way in which we move forward into this space? Because there is a mental health crisis. That is just the reality of the time that we live in. And we can analyze all the reasons why, and we've done a little bit of that. But man, are we hope carriers in the conversation as followers of Jesus. But we have to bring that into the reality of where people need that right now, which is in the mental health space. Small patterns, small engagement, small meetings, small steps, most of these are, but lead to significant change over time.
So we are out of time. We could genuinely talk about this for a huge amount of time. If you are going through any kind of mental health challenges, do talk to people, do get out there, do find some help. There is no shame in asking for help. We've been chatting about some of the impact and some of the contributing factors, but anyone can go through a mental health crisis. Anyone can find themselves in a place of difficulty. But please go out, get some help, talk to somebody, find some support. If you'd like to dig into some of the deeper questions that we've been exploring today, we've been quoting from our own book, So do check out Being Human, available at all major retailers. But otherwise, until next time, take care and God bless.